Welcome to CompTIA's Shark Bites podcast with Alan Shark, Executive Director at the Public Technology Institute.
Hello, everyone. This is Alan Shark, and welcome to CompTIA's Shark Bites, part of Public Technology's outreach to members and non-members alike. And today we have a treat. Today we're going to have a discussion and conversation with Dr. Terregas, Kostas Terregas, and somebody that I've known for many, many years. And for those of you who are not familiar with his name, someone who was the first president of the Public Technology Institute, although it was then Public Technology, Inc. And I think you were the third executive director, but the others had a very, very short stint. You were at PTI some 30 plus years. So tell us what led you to get into PTI in the first place?
Thanks, Alan. I was just a young kid with long hair, just fresh out of college. And it was 1971 and the big recession was on. And I sent out 81 letters to go teach, as all PhD students that get their PhD do. And I got one rejection letter and 80 silences. I was desperate. And I went, knocked on the door of the National Bureau of Standards. Back then, it was NIST today. And they said, we're interested in this set covering theoretical location packet that you've created for your PhD. Why don't you come work for us? But you know what? We're under a job freeze as well. So we're going to lend you to this organization that's struggling to get started. That was 1971. And that was the technology advisory program, technology assistance program. At the ICMA, the International City County Management Association. And as they say, the rest is history. ICMA took a grant from NASA to develop some tech transfer opportunities for local governments. Then the National League of Cities, the National Association of Counties, and the state organizations got together and said, why don't we do something in technology in general? In 1972, PTI was born, Public Technology Inc., it was called back then. I was given a tremendous opportunity to implement my doctoral dissertation in three cities with a HUD, Housing and Urban Development Grant. That package was called the Fire Station Location Package, and it then went on to be implemented in more than 300 cities and counties in the U.S. and Canada. So in a sense, I got drawn into PTI from my academic side. Found an opportunity to implement my doctoral dissertation. And then the more I talked to the mayors, to the managers, to the staff people in local government, I found this wonderful, marvelous world of commitment, of public service, and of desire to do things differently. And I said, I'm going to stay here. So when the feds came knocking back 2 years later and said, we can now hire you, I said, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stay right here in PTI.
Well, you set a high bar and a high standard. I'm glad to have carried the mantle for the last nearly 17 years. So you and I really take up some real estate in the history of PTI. So today you serve as a director of cybersecurity and privacy at the Privacy Research Institute at George Washington University. You are active as a IT advisor to the Montgomery County Council. You're a board member and finance director of the National Cyber League. You're an executive team member of the National Cyberwatch Center. You continue to keep incredibly busy. And so given your perch and your perspective, you have seen an awful lot over the years. Tell us about what you see moving forward, because you and I have had some discussions about policy and technology and the speed of change and innovation. How do you dice that up? How do you create a vision moving forward when you talk to governments across the country?
Thanks, Alan. And the first thing is collaborative action. And that's what created PTI. And I think you do a great job to continue that vision of collaborative action of local governments going forward. Holding hands with someone who feels the same pressures, who feels the same problems as you do, is vital in this rapidly changing world of technology. Technology has a way of overwhelming us. Our lawmaking is much slower than the technology that is creating opportunities for us to break laws that haven't even been written yet. I'll give you a couple of examples. Artificial intelligence, machine learning, Who's to say what's right and what's wrong? Right now, there's kind of an ethical imperative to figure out, where do you draw the line between what the machines can do and what the machines should be allowed to do? Is the line non-existent, or should we begin to draw some lines? Privacy comes into play, security comes into play. And when we look to our lawmaking bodies, Congress, state legislatures, county commissioners and commissions, city councils, they are overwhelmed with the options and the lack of real kind of analysis that can help them. So as a consequence, one huge imperative I see is to somehow allow lawmaking to catch up with the speed of technology. And again, the role for organizations such as Public Technology, such as other many fine organizations that have sprung up since PTI was born in the 70s is huge. So that's a real important imperative. On the other hand, I have to say that back in the 70s, the huge problem of inequities in our society was just beginning to be felt. We'd just gone through the 60s and riots, and we were still looking to see what are we going to do. Well, technology has accelerated the problems that we face. And today, in 2021, Alan, I have to say that we're not doing greatly in the digital divide. And again, you as an individual leader are doing a great job within the National Academy of Public Administration and elsewhere, trying to raise the level of discussion about digital equity and how technology can bring some economic opportunity and some educational opportunity to those that don't have it today. So it's funny to be sitting here today and to be talking about equity and social justice when in fact we've been at it for 50 years of my life and haven't been able to do much. So I feel a sense of disappointment there.
Yeah, and yet you are really ahead of the curve in thinking and sounding the alarm. I mean, I first got involved with you as you left PTI. You were heading the National Academy of Public Administration Social Equity Standing Panel. You chaired that for a number of years, and that was a real eye-opener to me. And isn't it interesting that both you and I, kind of technology-focused individuals, are kind of applying our knowledge to kind of seeing how this might help. And yet, as you point out, I mean, look at the pandemic, how this exposed something that had already been there. It just made it worse.
Absolutely. And in a sense, I see the pandemic and its devastating impact with some silver lining. Whenever we're faced with adversity, whenever we have a tragedy like the COVID-19 impact on this country and on many other countries around the world, just about all the countries around the world, we have to look for a silver lining. And I see two in the technology realm. So I'd like to tell your listeners to kind of think a happy thought. One of them is that it has given us a chance to rethink work because somehow, one way or another, we had to keep going. Governments had to keep providing services, but we had to rethink the way we did that. And of course, technology, which is your domain and mine, it lent a tremendously strong hand in rethinking and reevaluating the opportunities that we had to work. On the other hand, when we talk about the pandemic and its impacts, we saw that the act of being together with one another across geographies and across time became a little simpler. People agreed to take Zoom calls and to talk to people that they'd never have the chance to talk to before. All of a sudden, we began to talk to colleagues in Nigeria or in China at the drop of a hat. Whereas before, I remember reminiscences of TI when we had huge boxes like refrigerators that brought a human face to a meeting. Today, we have them on our iPhones and we have them on our Zoom calls. So this increased ability to talk to many people has been one of the silver linings I see in the pandemic itself.
Except for those who don't have access to reliable broadband. And that's really the problem.
And again, we have to keep on pushing that equity issue, especially in broadband, because I see broadband as three totally different things. One is the availability and affordability of just the signal. Secondly, the education of the individual that can then use whatever comes through that signal to his or her advantage. And then finally, the opportunity space that we allow people to enter when they have access to broadband. So these don't happen automatically. If you're a big company that can offer broadband to a particular region, to a particular neighborhood, say, yes, I've solved the problem. There's now broadband. It isn't over. Broadband is simply the first step. Broadband is opening the door to the opportunity, but you got to walk through. And to walk through, you have to be educated in how to use computers, how to use the iPhones. You have to own an iPhone. You have to be able to know what applications to use. And there has to be something on the other side of the application that wants you. So racial equity and social justice rears its head no matter whether we're technologically advanced or not. But for sure, broadband is the first step.
Yeah, and it reminds me, when I first came to PTI in 2004, I think it was within 3 weeks, I found myself traveling to Corpus Christi, Texas. And again, you were so ahead of the curve. I mean, PTI was in the forefront of Muni broadband. And you got involved with that very, very early on. You know, at that point, we were talking about the cloud, but we were referring to Wi-Fi as the cloud, not as we refer to it today. How do you feel about the 20 some odd states that have banned municipal broadband?
Yeah, their reality clashes with vision, Alan. And in a sense, broadband can be delivered many different ways. And Corpus Christi was way ahead of the curve some 20 years ago when they decided to put a mesh Wi-Fi network tethered on lamp poles. That would give internet signal to anyone that was around at municipal expense, as it were, because they saw the economic development imperative. So I think that the role that a local government or a state government can take to provide internet access is the same as the role we play to make sure that electricity is available, to make sure telephone service is available. We wrote laws about telephone service to make it mandatory to provide dial tone. Well, it's about time to write mandatory internet legislation at the federal level. Now, the difficult part is investment for the private sector. And we have huge private sector companies that have basically made it their life's work to provide signal, to provide internet access, to provide entertainment access. And we have to do so in a way that does not threaten or does not destroy the existing investment that has been made. We don't want to create stranded investments because after all, we are one community. So I think what's holding us back is the lack of a viable partnership model that would go a little bit more than the standard public-private partnership, which really doesn't say very much other than sounding good. We need a new model that would honor the stranded investment that has been made by industry already, and at the same time provide a role for local governments, city, county governments that want to play in this arena of providing broadband for economic development and for social equity purposes.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. Shifting gears, so much has been said the last number of years about innovation. What is your take on innovation today? Is that an overused term? I mean, I remember being at a conference and someone made a comment to me that I've never forgotten. Someone was getting an award at a major national organization. They said, you know, when my people hear about innovation, they run because it means that they're going to be displaced. It means someone's got an award for coming up with a new system that's going to replace 200 workers. I don't think that was ever the intent, but in some cases, innovation's gotten a bad rap. Some cases, it's been misused. Some cases, they believe it's only about technology when it isn't. What's your take on that?
Yeah. First of all, ever since I first walked in the public technology domain, I became a convert and a chief evangelist for innovation. In my mind, innovation is a new way of thinking about delivering service. Innovation is not technology. People sometimes make a mistake that they think, again, technology is the innovation. The innovation is in the way we provide services, the way we take three things, technology, people, and structure, and combine them together, or process, let's say, and the way we combine those three things, people, process, and technology, to create a different way of delivering a service to the public. The end result is the satisfaction of a demand that the public feels. It is not to deploy innovation. And unfortunately, it gets a little bit more clouded because companies, private sector companies that have created technologies, think that they know that their aim is to give the technology, to make sure it's sold into the public sector. So as a consequence, innovation has become identified one and the same as the technology itself. And that's wrong, because we have to look at the process. We have to look at people and their skills. And if we look at the people and their skills, by definition, we're not going to just fire them, because we're looking at them. We're going to upskill them to take advantage of new opportunities in new arenas. And again, perhaps state and local governments suffer a bit. I don't know much about the federal structure, but I can tell you I know a lot about state and local structure, and I think both those suffer a little bit from being too vertical in their structure. They're not thinking across the institution and across the human capital that they have and how to deliver services. They think about a department, and department owns a problem. And of course, the department stopped owning problems decades ago. Problems are really of the government, not of the department of the government.
Agreed. So I note that you are the director of cybersecurity at the Privacy Research Institute. You've spent an awful lot of time in recent years dealing with issues having to do with cybersecurity. The threat to local governments increases every single day with ransomware. Is there any end in sight to this?
Yeah. Again, not to be alarmist here, but the answer is no. Because we incentivize people to make money and to survive, and they found a very good job in attacking systems. And so there is no end in sight. But the good news, if you will, is that there is a response. And the response is, first of all, assume you're going to be hit. Assume that the bad people will be inside. And then create plans to manage your institution, your processes, assuming that you've been hit and assuming that the bad guys are inside your system. It's not as efficient as reality, but you have to be doing that. So if you're the mayor, if you're the manager of a particular town or county, you have to make that assumption. Secondly, I think for all too long, we've misplaced cybersecurity. We've made cybersecurity the responsibility of someone called a cybersecurity officer within the Office of the Chief Information Officer. I hate to tell you this, Alan, but I disagree. I think cybersecurity should be a direct report to the mayor or to the county commission. Cybersecurity is not about technology. It's about business continuity, and it's about safety of government operations. As a consequence, the placement of cybersecurity has to be elevated away from the CIO, away from the CISO, and be placed right inside the top level of the C-suite. If we do that, we will be able to see the investments necessary to secure the enterprise in a proper way. Right now, the priority is so low because it's one of the many things that the poor CIO has to worry about. We need to escalate it by giving it a direct report to the C-suite.
And my sense is the CIOs would probably welcome that.
Let's hope.
Yeah,
because that's the only solution for them. They'll get more investments. And again, this I would see that the CIOs will continue to run the machinery of the digital enterprise. So the CIOs will get more investments. Right now, the problem is they're not getting enough investment because it's part of their budget ask. It has to become part of the county commission's budget ask. We need this because otherwise our enterprise will not be able to operate.
Agreed. The other word in the institute in which you now work is the word privacy. So many people are concerned. And when it comes to digital equity, we have people, you know, on the have not scale that are very concerned about privacy. What what can we do to ensure that, I mean, security and privacy seem to go hand in hand, hence the title of what your institute is about. I mean, how do we address the privacy part of this?
Yeah, in a sense, Alan, for many years, we've talked about security and privacy being on opposite ends. The more security you have, you improve privacy and so on. But I'd like to suggest it's a triangle. We have security, we have privacy, and we have the ability to get things done. Within that triangle of security, privacy, and ability to get things done, we also have culture. And my son, who is in his 30s, has a totally different perspective on privacy than I do. So as a consequence, there is no unique privacy aspect. My privacy and the way I see privacy is different from his. He values the ability of getting things done far higher than his personal privacy. And that's his choice. And he thrives in that choice. As a consequence, we run the risk if we try to develop privacy structures which safeguard what a white male in his late career thinks about. We have to think about everyone. So as a consequence, privacy has to become much more flexible in order to be supported. On the other hand, we know so little about how we really feel about privacy. We only know, let's say, the tip of the iceberg. We see little anecdotes on Facebook or on Twitter, or we see maybe a horror story in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, but we don't really know much about it. So as a consequence, I think it's high time to go back to something that PPI really launched a long time ago, which is kind of, what are the needs of the people who are going to receive this technology, and needs assessment? We don't do a good enough job of assessing the needs in the privacy arena. We have a lot of privacy experts, but we need to hear from the people themselves, the 19-year-olds, the 35-year-olds, and the 60-year-olds, so that we can create an adequate and appropriate privacy domain for them.
You're so right about everyone has a different view of what privacy means to them. I mean, there are people giving out their whole lives on Facebook, and it's perfectly normal for them, sharing everything, vacations, dating, and then you have others who don't even appear for fear of giving away too much. You know, given the advent of GDPR and the fact that California passed the first privacy law, and I think Virginia has probably the second, and many communities have that, this kind of puts a sense of responsibility back in the hands of those who collect data about us. And that's the other part of it. It's one thing to kind of address what we are willing to share or not versus what's happening invisibly every time we go online. Does that change how you look at privacy today when you think about regulation and policy?
Yeah, so now we're back to what I said before about the role of lawmakers. Because inevitably, when you talk about regulation, you're back to government, and you're back to the way you write laws and you implement laws. I'm not convinced that the way we write laws is wealthy in its information quotient. I think that we need to inform lawmakers far better than simply having panels of experts drone on or questions being raised, which are more or less superficial, just eye-grabbing questions. We need to get a stronger methodology of creating laws. And that methodology may include the intergovernmental system in its entirety. It's madness to be thinking about regional laws and Europe-wide, to be thinking about national laws, to be thinking about state laws, and trying to align 50 states with all their whims and fancies. At the same time, if you write a national law, it has to be flexible enough to accommodate the different culture. And I talked about culture before. So we need a new way of writing laws, Alan, before I can answer your question. So, you know, we may need another 30 years to figure that one out.
You think it's time, though, to start thinking about a digital bill of rights? I mean, it seems to come back to individuals and their sense of rights. And in this fractured time where everybody has grievances, I'm wondering if that's something at least could unite people to at least starting a process of dialogue.
Absolutely. But the difference I would make is it's not only the role of a single body like Congress or the county commission. It has to involve the entire community that's impacted, which means all of us. So yeah, I think that would be a really good place to plant a flag.
Good. So as we look at where we are today with government and technology, opportunity, what excites you the most looking ahead?
What excites me the most, Alan, is the human being, you and me, individuals. Individuals continue to have an excitement about the future. Because I started in the technology realm and I'll end in the technology world, I can't imagine a future without excitement. I wish I was there 50 years from now so that I could see the amazing things that what we planted the seeds for has sprouted into full trees. So to me, it all starts from the individual. It all starts from our ability to listen carefully to what that individual needs and wants, and then to find collective solutions by holding hands with just as many people as we can. The age of the "I got the solution, if you would only drink this Kool-Aid" is over. We need to find better ways and new ways to collaboratively come up with solutions that will fit and will flex. And thank God for technology. Technology has now become very flexible. It used to be that it was just my way or the highway. Now it's extremely flexible. Everything can be localized to the individual, to the micro individual. So I'm very hopeful about the future. And I think with organizations like CompTIA and PTI, the future is very secure.
Thank you. Well, you know, I share your optimism. I mean, we're both eternal optimists, and we share so much in common in terms of our view of the world. But at the same time, I worry about how data fits into all of this. You talked earlier about we need to listen more. We need to do more needs assessment. We need to know more about what people want, assuming they know what their choices really are and informed the implications of each. But there's been some books recently released that talk about this growing trend among, I think, fairly large portions of our population that have complete distrust of data. And yet data drives everything. We started earlier talking about machine learning and artificial intelligence. Everything resides on data. How do we do a better job of validating data, which we know, if done right, can lead to much better decisions, much more efficient use of resources, but with such distrust, how do we overcome that?
Yeah, I've read some of these books. Shoshana Zuboff, for example, is tremendous, kind of lining out the reality of what's been happening while we're asleep. My answer is not to centralize power into a small organization or a small office that kind of runs the world and tells us what we should or should not do. It's in exactly the opposite direction. I see a revolution in the many-to-many. And the challenge for us will be to develop a governance of the commons, a structure for governing the commons that allows many-to-many strategies, which by themselves will begin to figure out what somebody's doing with the data, what's positive and what's negative. I think the way that we have tools to attack problems has to change. We used to think that the way to attack problems is to set up some kind of a hierarchical structure. That's gone. We are now in the period of network management and many-to-many strategies. So instead of thinking about who's going to control what, we have to start thinking, how can all of us, the billions of us that inhabit the earth, can actually do a better job of aligning each other. And we can do a better job than any one collective organizational node. So that's the decentralization solution that I see in the future.
So last topic, unless you want to add one, is cloud computing. When we first met a long time ago, cloud again was something that covered a city with Wi-Fi. Now it is basically remote computing or software as a service. What do you see as the future? I mean, many people have said, oh, cloud first is our new option. This is the great panacea. should local governments be kind of just saying, you know, that's got to be our future, as opposed to trying to maintain an infrastructure on premise? What's your take on cloud computing today?
Yeah, I see cloud computing as a very interesting alternative option, but it doesn't do away with the responsibility cities and counties will continue to have to manage their data. It's just like we started, you know, many years back with privatization and the notion that private companies can take away the problem. The problem never goes away. The problem is still owned by the community. So if we migrate to the cloud, the data problems will still be owned by the community, not by the company that runs the cloud. So we have to rethink how we approach cloud computing. It's not like the data is going to all go away to the cloud. It's that the data is going to become far better available to us to then manage in the way that we want to manage and to secure the way we want to secure. So I'm an advocate of the cloud. I'm an advocate of the fact that we can organize our lives on a phone, on a tablet, on a desktop, and with amazing ease find ourselves in our work, no matter which of the three options we choose, and no matter where in the world we are. I remember having to pack for my trips to Greece with, you know, kind of a full suitcase full of backup data disks and this is and that's. No more. I just have my phone and that's it. So it's an opportunity, but the opportunity is not to do away with the mentality of managing the data, because that's still always going to be ours.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Kostas, you have been terrific in this wonderful conversation. We've been listening to Dr. Kostas Tereghis, once upon a time, the president of the Public Technology Inc., then Institute, currently director of the Cybersecurity and Privacy Research Institute, part of George Washington University, and IT advisor to the Montgomery County Council, among many things. Kostas, is truly a pleasure. Thank you for spending the time with us today.
Very nice, Alan. Thank you very much.
This has been a production of PTI, the Public Technology Institute. To learn more, visit pti.org.